One day, earlier this year, my younger son invited me to see the jail that he had built out of his Legos. Silas is 4. He pointed with his tiny fingers to the place where the people who are bad are captured. And he told me a story. These people were building a city and they found an old jail in the woods. So they took it because everybody needs to put people in jail. And then they built their city around it. I'm so proud. The news is discouraging. From the overwhelming awe and heartbreak that we may have felt reading the new Jim Crow, learning about the scope and depth of incarceration of black men in the United States, to Ferguson, to Baltimore, to Charleston. Closer to home, there is systematic voter disenfranchisement, a widening income gap, the 3,000-pound gorilla in the room of climate change and environmental destruction. I have wondered in the face of all of this what tools this particular, peculiar religious upbringing is giving my children. What does our Unitarian Universalist faith have to say about living into this broken, beautiful, unequal world? And what are we doing here, in this place, on Sunday morning? We UUs spend a lot of time trying to explain to those outside of our movement what we even are. We spend a lot of time trying to agree within our movement about who we even are. Meanwhile, we lack flashy holidays or gory special effects. We can neither entice you with the magical promise of heaven nor threaten you with hell. It might be more convenient if we could, because the truth is, being a Unitarian Universalist, it's hard. As a practicing Unitarian, you will reject easy answers, the ones that seem so obvious to most everyone else. This can make family gatherings or phone calls with the grandparents just a bit awkward. And then you will be called to make yourself uncomfortable sometimes, voluntarily. And then, check this out, we'll ask you to invite your friends to make themselves less comfortable as well. With this kind of sales pitch, it's a good thing we don't work door to door. And so I wonder, what can I offer to either of my young sons to make any of this palatable, to make church, our church, and the call for transformative sacrifice appealing, to help them see the life-giving beauty of the idea it's not about you, in a larger society that says, put your quarter in and then kick that machine until it gives you your gumball. I think that there is an answer, and it's not just that our church is only for practicing masochists. What if our faith is also needed to help us connect deeply with hope? The other side of digging in our heels to stand on the side of love, this is like a physical challenge working with this lectern, and I take my hat off to Reverend Haley. The other side of digging in our heels to stand on the side of love, sometimes it is deep weariness. You may have wanted at some points this year to just stop walking, or at least to stop caring so much, to give your forehead some keyboard as you have read the latest gospel according to Facebook. We need hope. We need it as we take a stand against the deepening divide between rich and poor, against environmental destruction, against the kind of institutionalized racism that leads to churches on fire across our country in the year 2015. We need hope also in these smaller, simpler moments of our everyday lives. Consider this. Americans are working longer hours than ever, and meanwhile, wages in the last 10 years, they've remained stagnant, considered against inflation. The poorest in our nation have actually lost ground, and the middle class, too, is feeling the pinch. Perhaps you are. My family, too, we've added a kid since the crash of 2008, and nothing seems to go as far. This is fertile ground for scarcity mentality to take hold. There is not enough right now, and there might be even less tomorrow, or so we tell ourselves. Insert a 24-hour news cycle and connective technologies that we either cannot or do not want to turn off. Add also politics that at every level has become more dollar-driven than ever before. Politics that have learned that fear, your fear, is an excellent motivational tool. Put all of these things together, add a cumulative lack of sleep, a loss of meaningful touch or deep relationship with family or community, we are wired in this moment to react to negative stimulus. The world in the year 2015 can feel threatening and unsafe, even without unrest and injustice on the scale of what we've been seeing lately. But is this message of scarcity and fear how we want to live? And is it even true? Consider this. Did you know that violent crime is at its lowest level since 1978? And that is number of crimes. If you consider percentages, the average person is actually less likely to be murdered, assaulted, mugged, or brutalized, at least by those not in power, now than at almost any point. It's true. And at almost any point in American history. But do you feel that way? And do you see our police departments acting like that's true? Why are our 4-year-olds building jails if this is our larger context? Did you know also that we threw away enough food, and I don't mean your dinner scraps. I mean profit-incentivized mass dumping at the corporate level. Enough food to feed all of the hungry in America. That's 50 million people. If we just reduce food waste by half. That's abundance. What's with the scarcity mentality? Did you know also that educational attainment is up and continues to rise, with 90% of students nationwide graduating from high school for the first time ever last year? And that life expectancy in the United States hit a record high this year. We need to check our privilege, to share our wealth, and to fight for justice. But all is not lost. So does church matter in combating this relentless message of fear, of shortfall, in framing a better way to live? In demanding a response to victories and tragedies that reflects our human needs and allows us to shape a better tomorrow? You bet it does. Where besides our churches are you hearing this message? Who else is going to say this to you this week? It matters that we are together in worship each Sunday, because what happens here touches our souls. If we let it, this place will be a fulcrum for our weeks and a framing for our lives. But hearing a new message is just a starting point. What we must find is a different way of living and the comfort that gives us the strength to try it. We're dealing here with compassion burnout, and the treatment is threefold. We nourish ourselves, bodies and souls. Second, we have to change our definition of success. And third, we must know with the confidence of deep faith that the work of our own hands, what we each can do, that's enough. I hope that the rituals you participate in here at Foothills are part of what nourish you. They extend well beyond the worship hour. If you meet for coffee or a church picnic, breaking bread together before a meeting, you're nourishing yourselves, bodies, and also spirits. Our airlines have a phrase for this. They call it putting on your own oxygen mask. The idea is that in the event of unexpected difficulties, you have to attend to yourself. Not eventually when you get around to it. You have to do it first. Only then can you count on being in a position to help others. Our faith communities are part of this ethic. We care for ourselves that we may leave strengthened to care for the world outside our doors. Soul nourishment is not just about food. We also feed ourselves with beauty. That may look like starlings or like art or like the faces of your grandchildren. We feed ourselves also with rest. And so knowing this, I ask you, what care will you offer to yourself this week? What will you do to feed your soul? Our second task moves from using our bodies to using our brains. We're going to change the definition of success. Unitarian Universalist theologian Dr. Sharon Welch, who is one of my professors at Meadville Lombard Theological School, she takes this idea on in her book, A Feminist Ethic of Risk. Perhaps surprisingly, this is not a book about feminism per se. It's about reclaiming the definition of success from a traditional winner-take-all, the problem is solved or we failed business model. Challenges as complex as racism, poverty, and gun violence, they're what social theorists have begun to call wicked problems. A wicked problem has multiple and hidden causes, deep interrelationships with other challenges, and under a traditional way of looking at things, it's unsolvable. In other words, it's hopeless. Except, Welch says, that's a ridiculous way of looking at the world, our world, the only one we have. If our way of seeing solutions means that we cannot make things better, the option isn't to give up. It's to find a different way. We are told every day that we are powerless to change things. Think about the sources of those messages and the incentives behind them. Our shared task is not simply to fight injustice then, but to stand firm against the larger sense of disempowerment, to reclaim hope. The feminist part of Welch's book is a reframing of what progress means, because we have to let go of the idea that things are only worth doing if we're likely to see swift, clear fruits of our labors. What Welch tells us, what my UU faith tells me, is that the struggle itself is noble, and it is that struggle over a long time and in the face of long odds that changes things. Empowerment is so important, and it matters on an individual level too, which brings me to our third task, the heart task, the faith task, which is what makes what we do here in religious community different from our work in the rest of the world. We must know that what we each can do, that starting place, however small it feels, it's enough. The Benedictine Catholics call this idea radical hospitality. They have built a rule of living around the idea that help the one next to you, the one in your path, is both sufficient and sacred as a response to the world's problems, the hunger and weariness around us. We follow this spiritual guidance when we accept the one in our path as ours, helping without worry as to whether helping that one weary traveler eases the burdens of all travelers everywhere. In fact, Benedictine spirituality says that it is not for us to wonder, to ask that question about all of the travelers. We're simply called to be God's hands and feet here on earth. And there is beauty in that. And yet, as Unitarian Universalists, we may wonder if that larger question, how do we help solve the larger problem, is in fact our question. And I don't disagree with you. And so I'm going to tell you a fish story. It may be familiar to you, it almost certainly is familiar to your children. Perhaps you remember the movie Finding Nemo. It's a Disney Pixar animated feature from 2003. Toward the end of that movie, a bunch of sardines are caught in a net that is being hoisted from the sea at the end of a crane. The fish are heavy and the crane is struggling a bit from that load. But what's needed for those fish to escape, and this is all told from the fish's perspective, what's needed for those fish to escape is extra force. The problem, though, is that all of those 1,000 fish caught in the net are swimming in different directions. They are panicked, they're confused, and they're acting as frightened individuals. Nemo, a young clownfish who has struggled up to this point to find his identity as a leader, he's caught in the net too, but he's small enough to escape. Rather than fleeing, however, Nemo sees what must be done and he sticks around at great risk to himself to try to convince the other fish to save themselves. And what can save them is so very simple. Nemo takes a deep breath and then speaks the encouragement that can change everything. Swim down together. His voice isn't enough, though. He needs others to be speaking the same truth, and so he swims in and out of that net, telling every fish he touches, tell everyone to swim down together. And you know what? Those fish do it. First a few, and then more, and then all of them. And does that remind you of anything? Hundreds of thousands of voices speaking out in favor of Planned Parenthood, leading to a reversal within 24 hours of the Komen Foundation's decision to defund them. Federal and then state and then local judges acting in favor of marriage for everyone, leading to a historic moment last week in which marriage and love are the law of the land for everyone. And we know that that didn't start with the judges. It started with the voices of the people, including some of you right here. Swim down together. More than 1 million people speaking out to tell their stories so that the health care bill could become a reality, and who continue to fight across the center of our country for Medicaid expansion that can save lives. The Black Empowerment Movement, known as Black Lives Matter, is a swim down together moment. And in reclaiming hope, we can add our voices to those voices we can watch with a newly framed vision of what progress looks like. And when we see dissent, when we see a flagpole climber like Bree Newsom, we can say, here comes hope. There is so much out there to convince us that our voices do not matter, that we're licked before we even start, that things are going from bad to worse, and the only way we can cope is to shut that still small voice inside of us up. Be ours a religion that counters the toxic belief that a single voice of dissent does not matter. Be ours a faith that models the heart and courage to act not in isolation and fear, but together. Be ours a church that helps us to pause and be nourished, leaving comforted and strengthened each week to take one more step. Until there is peace in the streets and peace in the homes, and until our four-year-olds stop building us jails and start handing out stars, we have work to do. And our first task is to keep our hopes alive. Amen.